Okay, we're back for episode 118. Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. Sorry about last night. I disconnected at the end of the show. I had a power outage here in Santa Barbara. Our grid is shaky, so I'm happy to be fully electronic tonight. So we shouldn't happen again, hopefully.
Okay, if the power fails, just put your wife on the treadmill.
Yeah, that's right.
So, okay, well, tonight we agreed to talk about, Fidel Castro, the late Fidel Castro. And, of course, Fidel Alejandro Castro Ruz, was born August 1926 and died in 2016. So he lived to be over 90. He was a Cuban communist revolutionary and politician who governed the Republic of Cuba as prime minister from 1959 to 1976, and then as president from 1976 to 2008, a Marxist-Leninist and Cuban nationalist. Castro also served as the first secretary of the Communist Party of Cuba from 1961 until 2011. Under his administration, Cuba became a one-party communist state, while industry and business were nationalized and state socialist reforms were implemented throughout society. Born in Barón Oriente as the son of a wealthy Spanish farmer, Castro adopted leftist and anti-imperialist politics while studying law at the University of Havana. After participating in rebellions against the right-wing governments in the Dominican Republic and Colombia, he planned the overthrow of Cuban President Fulgencio Batista, launching a failed attack on the Moncada barracks in 1953. After a year's imprisonment, Castro traveled to Mexico, where he formed a revolutionary group, the 26th of July movement. I think that was the date of that assault on the barracks. 26th of July movement, with his brother Raul Castro and Che Guevara. Returning to Cuba, Castro took a key role in the Cuban Revolution by leading the movement in a guerrilla war against the Batista's forces from the Sierra Maestra Mountains. After Batista's overthrow in 1959, Castro assumed military and political power as Cuba's prime minister. The United States came to oppose Castro's government and unsuccessfully attempted to remove him by assassination, economic blockade, and counter-revolution, including the Bay of Pigs invasion of 1961. Countering these threats, Castro aligned with the Soviet Union and allowed the Soviets to place nuclear weapons in Cuba, sparking the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think we'll have more to say about that. This was supposedly a defining incident of the Cold War in 1962. Adopting a Marxist-Leninist model of development, Castro converted Cuba into a one-party socialist state under the Communist Party's rule, the first in the Western Hemisphere. Policies introducing central economic planning and expanding health care and education were accompanied by state control of the press and suppression of internal dissent. Abroad, Castro supported anti-imperialist revolutionary groups backing establishment of a Marxist government, of Marxist governments in Chile, Nicaragua, and Granada, as well as sending troops to aid allies in the Yom Kippur in the Angolan Civil War. These actions, coupled with Castro's leadership of the Non-Aligned Movement from 1979 to 1983 and Cuba's medical internationalism, increased Cuba's profile on the world stage. Following the Soviet Union's dissolution in 1991, Castro led Cuba through an economic downturn of the special period, embracing environmentalist and anti-globalization ideas. In the 2000s, Castro forged alliances in Latin America. This is the Pink Tide, namely with Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, and signed Cuba up to the Bolivarian Alliance for the Americas. In 2006, Castro transferred his responsibilities to Vice President Raul Castro, who was elected to the presidency by the National Assembly in 2008. the longest-serving non-royal head of state in the 20th and 21st centuries, Castro polarized world opinion. His supporters view him as a champion of socialism and anti-imperialism, whose revolutionary regime advanced economic and social justice while securing Cuba's independence from American imperialism. Critics view him as a dictator whose administration oversaw human rights abuses, the exodus of a large number of Cubans, and the impoverishment of the country's economy. Well, that's sort of the received official view of Castro. Castro, the revolutionary, depends whether you're left or right, whether you view him as a villain or a hero or somewhere in between, of course. The story, I think, is a bit more convoluted, and there's a lot more question marks about Castro, really, about that whole era, about the Cold War, you could say. You know, of course, there's been some rumors that Fidel Castro himself came from a converso family, Sephardic Jewish family. I've heard that. Even stories that he is actually the father of the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. If you look at pictures of him, they do look awfully alike. Some say the chronology doesn't work out, but it is funny. And, of course, I think we'll get into, you know, who was Fidel Castro? Was he, in your words, a lifetime actor? Was he set up? Was it, you know, we've talked about the Cold War sort of being a staged or set up dialectic at a meta level, just the whole thing kind of a show. Of course, below that level, you had actors and participants who actually were true believers or thought they were fighting the good fight on both sides. But we can talk about that. So, Joe, Fidel Castro, what's your take on the late dictator of Cuba?
Jefe.
Jefe, that's right.
I mean, I'm glad we're talking about him because I think he's very interesting and important to kind of get. Castro helps explain, if you kind of understand, in my opinion, you sort of get the whole nature of the false reality. A couple of years ago, I spent like 3.5 weeks in Cuba. Had a legal license to go. This was before, you know, people were permitted in, but they were permitting educational groups to go. And I applied to the Treasury Department as a micro-organic farmer, referring to the two raised beds in our backyard, saying I wanted to go and study Cuban, like, ways they had dealt with the drought, because at that time in California, we were having one of our droughts. And so I said, so I need to go there. So lo and behold, they issued a license and off I went, and I spent 3.5 weeks there. And the truth about Castro and about the revolution and about the Cuban Missile Crisis and really about the whole Caribbean political dimension of fake, you know, reality is immediately transparent when you just walk down the Grand Avenue in Havana, because you have all of the homes are dilapidated. Now, the homes are absolutely beautiful construction, but, you know, Cuba has no money, and so they have a hard time keeping them up, and so they get black mold on them. And so all of the houses are fighting it. And I mean just, 50,000 homes or maybe more are battling with this thing in buildings. And all of the buildings have the same problem, the old high-rises. But there are three buildings which are good looking. One are the hotels, and this is where the tourists are. And there is, even at that time, though there wasn't U.S. tourism, there was a lot of Canadians. They were like doing these Hemingway tours where they would, get drunk in the Floridita and then face plant in the same gutter that Hemingway did.
The Hemingway tour, I like that. Okay.
Hemingway tour, it was just disgusting. I mean, I wanted to burn every Hemingway book I'd ever even seen, you know, after looking at these Hemingway tours. It was just because they're just drunken, kind of free-for-alls. And then they have pictures of Hemingway at these different places in drunken free-for-alls. You know, I mean, it's just bombed in all these pictures. So it's just kind of an alcohol-sodded, you know, presentation of Hemingway, where he's being, you know, worshipped by all these drunk, typically Canadians, you know. And so it was kind of just a horrible thing to look at. But anyway, the thing that was just overwhelming is that, so you have the hotels, and then you have government buildings. And these are typically new. They were built probably during the Soviet era. And so they're not dilapidated at all. They look a little, you know, kind of monolithic. They have that kind of Soviet gigantism sort of thing. Yeah. So they're not pretty. They're not like the other Spanish colonial structures in Havana. But then the real colossus, and it is absolutely beautiful and maintained, is the Freemason Lodge, the Grand Lodge of Havana. And I mean, you just have to see it to see how overwhelming it is to the city of Havana.
Yeah, Wasn't Simon Bolivar a Mason?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, yeah.
That whole revolution, 19th century, was Masonic.
This is, I don't want to be like long-winded. I'm happy to talk about my experience in Havana because it was kind of fun, sort of some cool, weird things happened. But the thing that was completely transparent is I went into the lodge. I thought, well, heck, I'll just go in and ask him some questions. Now you can't get into the lodge. Now you can't get in. But on the street, the Cubans are very forthcoming. And, you know, people say, well, it's, you know, this communist controlled. It's like 1950s Hungary. There's spies everywhere. You know, it's not like that. I don't think the government has any money. They don't have enough money to have spies. There's no police. There's no military present. The Cubans are pretty cynical about communism. They're all trying to make money. You know, every one of them is a little sort of entrepreneurial capitalist. They're all desperate to see if they can get your tourist dollars away from you with some, you know, kind of little business idea. But when you talk to them, they all, you know, you talked about Fidel being a converso. This is just how they understand it. They go, yeah, his family was Jewish. Mm-hmm. The people I talked to, they didn't have any question about it. They go, why is this even an issue? He goes, yeah, of course. They weren't Catholic. You know, this is just known by all the people who knew him. And then when I tried to ask him about the revolution, they're all very pleased about the revolution because remember it, you know, this dialectic, it replaced Meyer Lansky.
Yeah.
And Bugsy Siegel, just if you don't mind, digress a little bit about Meyer Lansky. When I was there, I went down these boulevards, which were where the prostitutes were, just row after row of these kind of 3-4-story buildings that were used for prostitution and gambling. Meyer and Bugsy Siegel had set this up with Batista, the dictator that Fidel overthrew. And the Cubans are really raw about this because such a large fraction of their women had been basically enslaved as sex, you know, purveyors, right?
Yeah, this was sexual tourism.
You know. It was sexual tourism, yeah, in the 50s. And when I talked to them, you know, they said that Meyer would arrange for, like, troublesome prostitutes to become addicted to heroin. That was one of his supposed, this was something I was told by people on the street, and not just by one person, just because I was trying to get to, you know, get my best understanding of this. And they said, yeah, you know, women, there wasn't any money, and this was how they could make a living. And if they complained, they, you know, they try to get them addicted to heroin. And I thought, gee, didn't Meyer Lansky get the humanitarian award of like guy of the year from B'nai B'rith?
Oh, no, it's his business partner, Mo Dalitz.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I get that confused.
It was the Torch of Liberty Award.
Yeah, Torch of Liberty. So anyway, so Meyer was not much of a humanitarian, and the Cubans are still really raw about this.
Mo was more successful in converting, like he got into philanthropy and kind of went became legit when he retired, but just by throwing his money around. And so,
well, you know, congrats to him. So this was the Cuba that, you know, Fidel came in. They were 98-99% illiterate. They worked on the sugar plantation, the men, and they were basically slaves.
Oh, sorry, but from what I understand, is Meyer Lansky's granddaughter does work for the ADL.
Yeah, so. I've heard that. Yeah, so no problem. But anyway, so you've got this. So you have this, and you know, very repressive slave type situation, and along comes Castro. The people speak about the revolution as their revolution. They think it's glorious, you know, think it's great. But they also see, you know, we have no money. And we really don't, they're hopeful about political power. I mean, right now, I think Raul is still alive, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He must be about a million years old. But the Communist Party, in the way that their structure works, is still, you know, basically in control of the country. So you know, they think they're free. They think they're in a worker's paradise, but they're really, and there is no prostitution that is forced on the women of Cuba, but it is a pretty feudal kind of setup in my mind. But the fact is that another kind of rumor about Castro that people there just absolutely affirmed was that when Castro had come to Cuba to form the revolution, he actually stayed in the Freemason Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
So, and his brother Raul is just an outed Mason. That was converted. Whereas Castro, Fidel was not. It was not clear if he was or not. People thought he was because he stayed at the Freemason Lodge. Why wouldn't he be? But it was. He wasn't outed. Raul is just. He attends the ceremonies and whatnot. And so, then looking at, you know, going backwards into, you know, time, you can see that Cuba had a whole series of people before Fidel that created the kind of nationalism and workers' paradise and let's rebel from colonialism movement. And you have like guys like Cesar Puedes, and the most important was Jose Marti. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but mm-hmm. And he led rebellions, and he was kind of like, I would say, he would be a parallel to Garibaldi. He was a nationalist, but all of the people came before Fidel, they're all Masons. They're all members of Freemasonry, and they all juxtaposed the freedom that they were claiming to be trying to bring about with the oppression of Catholicism.
Yeah.
If you really look at what's happened, you had a Catholic colonial empire in the Caribbean and Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
And this was attacked by various nationalist movements, but all of them were led by Masons. So really, in my opinion, what happened is that one form of colonial dictatorship was replaced by another. I mean, if you characterize the Catholic colonial situation as a dictatorship, it I think probably pretty fair. I mean, very little democracy in most of these Catholic colonies. But anyway, the idea that if you would just join the revolution, that things would get better, turned out to be false everywhere, just everywhere throughout the Caribbean. In Cuba, they even have like some of the stuff that's in the, like in Haiti, the Tonton, Makuta, you know, voodoo, this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
This is all Freemasonic. I mean, it's not even, you know, if you talk to the people who studied it, they say, yeah, it's sort of like a Caribbean Prince Hall version of Freemasonry. It's not officially organized as like Prince Hall is in the United States. But Freemasons have basically created a kind of mysticism. They took the African indigenous religions and weaponized them, you know, and they end up with, voodoo and, people coming back from the dead zombies. I mean, gee, I wonder where they get these concepts from. It sounds like a Hollywood movie. But Castro, in my opinion, was, he was a Masonic lifetime actor. I think, in my opinion, that the whole thing was scripted. In other words, he couldn't come in and say he was a Marxist because the people, it was a Catholic country, they wouldn't have put up with that. So he came in as basically a Cuban nationalist, and then just by a bizarre circumstance, he had to drop the mantle of Marxist, right? Like if you go through the process how he became a Marxist, it was the U.S. and they said, we're going to help out. And so that was how he transitioned to Marxism. But the transition occurred long after he had power. This is a key thing. So once he was in power, and it was from the very beginning a dictatorial situation, I mean, they were executing people like crazy. And this was in the pre-Marxist era. You know, this was in just the revolutionary period before Fidel flipped over into Marxism. Anyone who was opposed to, Fidel's power, they just shot him. And he had, Che Guevara, who was just a complete bloodthirsty psychopath, as kind of his henchman. And they would just, have a 5-minute trial and then just execute 10 people. And so there was intimidation from the very beginning, and the people were you know, even though they were told it was their rebellion and the prostitution stopped and public education occurred, different things occurred, the actual real political power just flipped into, you know, the control of a group that now were supposedly Marxists but had a background in Freemasonry. And now the next thing you know, you have the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this is my honest opinion, Tim. I think the whole thing was a script. I know you did an interview with a guy who took the position or takes position that Castro is CFR, and I want to shut up here in a second and let you, because I'm curious about this, the interview you did with this guy. But my opinion is that they arranged so that Fidel could present himself as a Marxist, because this is a cover under which the Soviet Union can now become buddies, and they can, you know, bring in these missiles, and we have the Cuban Missile Crisis. In my opinion, the Cuban Missile Crisis was the fakest. I mean, it was like a Disney cartoon. There was just nothing real about it whatsoever. The whole purpose of it was to terrorize the American people and the world in general concerning nuclear weapons, so that they would want to have, you know, a big government, you know, to both military to defend them and secret projects to develop secret type weapons. And of course, a lot of snooping on the people to make sure that there weren't commies running around, you know, trying to plant nuclear weapons everywhere. So I just think that if you kind of come to the point of understanding Fidel in the way I suggest, you've really understood the world, because now you can see that these things are fake. They're just done to create psychological conditions. I know you had you've done an interview with, I forget his name. What was his name?
Servando Gonzalez.
Right, and he took the position that Castro was CFR. Can you tell us about that? Because that, I just find that to be like so logical.
Well, just going back in Castro's history, there's some anomalies that don't seem to add up. One thing is he as a youth, he tried out for the New York Giants pitcher. And yeah, he actually was in some Hollywood movies. One was an Esther Williams film. He has IMBD page. He has some years unaccounted for in the United States, particularly in New York. And some people suspect that he not only, you know, was he housed at the Masonic Lodge in Havana, but he also was put up at the Pratt House, which is the headquarters for the CFR up in New York. And he saw him as a CFR agent, and sort of, you know, how the ruling elite will manage the dialectic, and they're bringing about various revolutions and holding on to power in these things. And that's the function that Fidel Castro served. The while back, New York Times, you know, reported, and this was known beforehand, but that in the 1950s, Fidel Castro was the recipient of CIA largesse. I mean, he was getting arms and financing by the CIA. I think one Barry Seal, who ties into a lot of, you know, drug running in the 70s and 80s for the CIA, and also connects to this, to the Kennedy assassination. He was a drug runner, a pilot, who actually was close to Lee Harvey Oswald, the Operation 40 gang. This is a group of sort of CIA agents, assassins, and, you know, sort of these guys that were involved in all these, you know, dirty little wars in Latin America at the time. The idea was, of course, that said that the CIA was trying to earn, you know, sort of play, playing both sides in Cuba, but the CIA dethroned Batista. They wanted him out, and they wanted Castro in, and then some say then Castro became alienated from the United States, and then that's when he became a Marxist-Leninist and took up with the Soviet Union. But that's an explanation, but I don't know if it really bears scrutiny. What was going on there is the Cuban Missile Crisis. In terms of the Cuban Missile Crisis, even the, you know, prior to that in 61, and you had the Bay of Pigs, which was just a setup, it was designed to fail, and some people say it was designed to sandbag JFK into authorizing a full scale invasion of Cuba. That's one level of understanding. But another level of understanding is this would earn Castro bona fides in the eyes of the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union, and Servando Gonzalez points out, was very distrustful of Castro and suspicious of Castro at the time. And this, something like the Bay of Pigs would have earned sort of his street cred as a true enemy of the United States, an enemy of imperialism. So it was sort of staged for that reason. The Cuban Missile Crisis a year later in October, he says that when people talk about the presence of nuclear missiles in Cuba, there really is no evidence for it. And he cites the fact that photo reconnaissance films, and there was no human intelligence, if you know anything about intelligence, that's what you really rely upon, not just for reconnaissance photos, because all you really had were large objects covered up under canvas. There was never any physical inspection or proof of nuclear missiles presence in Cuba at the time. Like you said, what this was sort of a strategy of tension, scare the American public into accepting, things of the Cold War. And it's interesting that, what was published or released in the about 19 years ago as a part of the fire release of the Kennedy assassination was the revelation of Operation Northwoods, which was a plan by the Pentagon and the CIA to stage false flags, carry out fake and real attacks on American soil to justify an invasion of Cuba. And so, again, this is something where a figure like Castro would justify such things and justify that, sort of the secret of deep state, the secret agencies and the fact of the existence of Operation Mongoose and assassination teams. And this would lead to this sort of this alliance between the CIA and the mafia, because they're utilized. The mafia was utilized as part of Operation Mongoose to sort of to take out Cuba, because the mafia had a vendetta against Castro because Castro had nationalized or seized the casinos and forced Meyer Lansky out. And so that was their vendetta. It isn't to say that maybe figures in the mafia had a full understanding of these things, because it seems to me in the broader picture, the mafia at this stage was being brushed aside by the true mafia, which is the Rothschilds, the CFR and the financial elite, and what we consider the mafia was then being brushed aside. This will appear like Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana, both would be murdered in the 1970s in the middle of the congressional investigation on the Kennedy assassination, the reinvestigation of the Kennedy assassination that was being conducted in the mid-1970s. But he just cites that, going back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, is there wasn't any indication, there was no sign of radiation. There's no reports of, when you have missiles, they report. There's a report. You just radiate. You can detect it. And nor did the Kennedy never ordered sort of the inspection when they were leaving. You think they would have inspected the ships when they were leaving as part of the deal. That never happened. So his idea is really, if you look at it, all you have are claims of the U.S. government and the Soviet Union, and also Castro himself, that there was indeed a Cuban Missile Crisis. But there really is no independent or real physical evidence of those missiles ever existing. And if you look at the broader geopolitical situation, it really makes no sense, to put missiles, on the Cuban shores, 90 miles from American islands, from America's borders. It didn't really change. It was more, it was almost more of a symbolic gesture.
Well, it made no sense from the military perspective, because they had submarines. They could get missiles 90 miles from the U.S. without this big political kerfuffle. Now, the reason that whole Cuban Missile Crisis thing was created was just to structure terror as a concept to make the American people specifically more compliant. And the fact that, there wasn't any radiation signatures, which would have been the case if there were atomic weapons, just as sort of underlines the fact of it was just the whole thing was just theater. I wanted to go back to the Bay of Pigs, because I was at the Bay of Pigs, Tim. Actually went down the road that the invaders took. And it's really quite a trip, because they have billboards marking the battles. There was they came on shore. We call it the Bay of Pigs. It's Playa Jaron. Mm-hmm. And so they came on shore. They were in United Fruit donated boats. A couple thousand. I mean, it was just a small little force. They had some good weapons. But so they come down this road. There's no cover at all. I mean, you're talking about shrubs and like sugar cane. I mean, there's really no place to hide. There was just this road. And so when you drive down the road to the Bay of Pigs, where they landed, you have these billboards. And the billboards just describe the little skirmish that took. And the skirmishes get weaker and weaker as you go down, as you go away from the beach, because there's fewer and fewer people to fight. You know, they just slaughtered these guys that they, who came on shore. They were basically, I think there was 1,500. Don't quote me on this, but it was a small force. They had like over 20,000 mechanized troops that they were basically surrounding them with, and just blew the tar out of them, and then until they surrendered. But here's my take on the whole thing. It was completely fake. What they were really doing is they landed them in this particular area. Now, they claimed, the Cuban nationalists who were, you know, on board and working with the CIA, they claimed that, well, we knew this was a place we could get popular support. It was a completely Catholic area. And they were playing the dialectic that he's now a Marxist, he's anti-Catholic, and because you're Catholics, you're going to support us. And that was what the actual claim was as to why they landed on a flat beach with no cover and walked straight down a road with no place to hide and no mechanized vehicles or anything, and just got the snot blown out of them. Because they thought the people were going to rally to their side. Well, in my opinion, what they were doing is it was basically the old Freemason Catholic dialectic. See, this is the real dialectic. This is the real underlying dialectic of history. It isn't this all these other twisting and turning, the workers' paradise stories, you know. It's just the good old-fashioned Freemasons versus the Roman Catholic political power. And so what the Bay of Pigs was really just a way to give Castro cred with the Catholics, because when this group came and they said, you know, join us in the rebellion, they were trying to appeal to the Catholics. And Fidel had been kind of ambivalent with the Catholics before the rebellion, but after, they all went over to siding with him. They said, no, we're Cubans, you know, we may be Catholics, but we're going to stick with this guy because he's a real Cuban. He may be Marxist. But so I think that the whole Bay of Pigs things was just kind of a agitprop moment for Castro, so that the Catholics would see him as, you know, Cuban, and the Yankee, you know, nationalist Catholic Cubans as the bad guys. I think it was just simple as that.
Apparently, Castro's favorite baseball team was the New York Yankees.
Sure, of course. I mean, Castro, I don't know. He's once you sort of get him as a lifetime actor, he's a lot more amusing.
Well, people talk about who meet him. He has sort of a mesmerizing effect on people, and you get this. You read a lot of the biographies, and people get fooled by him. And this is what you'd get for someone who's trained in this position. And he had sort of the romance. I mean, he was young. He was in his early 30s when he seized power. He was 33. If I do my math right, you're 32 or 33, and he, you know, and he was this young revolutionary, and he ran around that military, you know, the olive drab outfit with the cigar and the beard, just sort of a mixture of machismo and romantic revolutionary. Guevara did the same thing, and Servando Gonzalo surmises that Che Guevara was a true believer, and it was Castro that set him up to be murdered in 1967 in Bolivia.
Sure. Yeah. He absolutely got rid of him because he was a true believer, and it wasn't something that could be controlled in the theater of the dialectic absurd that Castro was running. He was real, and so he had to get rid of him because he needed to have nothing but other actors around him to manage this whole charade. I mean, they were, and of course, when he died, he becomes a martyr. So again, it's the management of understanding of history for the Cuban people.
Yeah.
I mean, the Cuban people just got played. They got played by Freemason actors, just like, you know, the poor Russians, the creation of the German Nazi party. I mean, the same script gets just played over and over again in history. You have the Catholic political power, the Masons come in, they whip up some cockamamie story about rebellion. I mean, look at like Garibaldi in Italy, you know, with the insane Helen Blavatsky. You know, I mean, all of the nationalist movements that swept across Europe in the 19th century, they're all Freemasonic, mm-hmm. all promising the workers' paradise. They're all trying to use the nationalism as a way to rally people against Catholic power. And then in the Caribbean, just everywhere, you had the same thing. When we talked about Gary Webb, you know, we talked about this ridiculous Nicaraguan situation where the Ortega brothers talk about, well, we learned how to fight in the Masonic temple. Mm-hmm. This is where we learned how to roll, right. And we just decided to name them the Sandinistas after Mexico's most famous Freemason, you know, Sandino.
Yeah.
So it's just ridiculous.
And the Revolution of Mexico is an example of a Masonic revolution.
It's the dialectic. It's, if you dig in there, you can find it. It's the Freemason versus Catholic political power. Yeah. That was the real dialectic and that was going on between, you know, like 1700, you know, up to like, you know, war, end of World War II.
Yeah, the 1820s and then leading up to the Spanish-American War, you know, Cuban independence was won by, you know, by the force of American arms when they, you know, stoked up that war against Spain in 1898, and it was under, you know, military, U.S. Occupation on and off, and then, you know, Batista, I think, was installed in the late 30s. One thing that's interesting is Castro himself, you know, the revolutionary Castro, you know, there's been accusations that he also was involved in drug running. That wouldn't surprise me at all. He got involved. He sent soldiers, you know, like 100,000 soldiers to fight in like the Angolan Civil War. And his regime was paid to guard Western oil companies' oil fields in Africa during the height of the Cold War. Gulf Oil and Chevron, sure. You know, so you have a communist dictator dispatching troops to protect the assets, you know, of oil companies in the midst of a civil war, you know, which is all part of the Cold War dialectic, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is that.
So why is a communist defending the?
right. Well, I mean, it's yeah. Because they're not very dedicated to the cause, yeah. You know, and. If the communists were so interested in communism, why haven't they given political power to the people? You know, why 70 years into the revolution, they're still basically they function as a dictatorship inside of Havana.
Well, I mean, it's the same reason why David Rockefeller, during his time, could fly into Moscow at any time and, you know, meet with the Soviet leadership and why Wall Street and London banks, you know, we're financing the Bolsheviks and, you know, Lend-Lease, World War II, and these things, and, you know, how policies always seem to help, at least in that part of the world, the communists. And, you know, you fund your alleged enemy so he can be your enemy in the future. That's a good example with, you know, with Ho Chi Minh and also with the on the Korean Peninsula, where whole thing was set up to be future conflict.
That the North, both North Vietnam and North Korea were given to them by the Allies, mm-hmm. You know, at the end of World War II for the express purpose of letting them create a military structure that then the U.S. and the West could fight against.
Yeah, they're nudging the French out so the OSS and CIA could take over the heroin trade.
Yeah, and again, the French were, Golden you Triangle. Know, more Catholic and, you know, of course, at the end of World War II, probably not. But anyway, so this is the... You know, the kind of looking at Fidel, you know, you can look at him as sort of a legit character of history and the world is simply insane, you know, or you can try to study a little bit more into his background. And when you look into like his experiences in Pratt and his relationships, and there's so many of them to the CFR, you go, wait a second, this guy doesn't look like you know, some kind of Marxist revolutionary. And then when you look at him as, you know, even his appearance, you know, it just seems sort of fake, you know. I mean, the cigar, the beard, always mm-hmm. keeps the hat on. You know, he's like a military, he's like literally playing a revolutionary, you know, his outfit is the revolutionary.
Comandante.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, this is how they create the sense of history that then people, use to now accept basically the Cold War, right? Because the Cold War was very expensive. A lot of technology had to be developed, missiles and DARPA, and all of the basically all the snooping technology can goes back into a war, to the Cold War with the Soviet Union, where we had to develop all of these fancy spying capacities. I mean, even MK Ultra was justified, by the idea of like we can't let the Soviets, get ahead of us in the,
it
brain.
It was a mind control gap.
Yeah, the mind control
missile gap, mind control gap, and that was came out of the Korean War. Yeah,
we're desperate, and we have to, and so. So this is what keeps us basically enslaved. We have to just stop the nonsense, look at these people, at least analyze them as lifetime actors, for the possibility they could be. And then, I think you'll see that the world start making it makes a whole lot more sense. It becomes a lot more logical. The events, are no longer just head scratchers like building sevens verticals, symmetrical collapse, You don't have to defy the laws of physics in order to hold on to your understanding of history, so this is why Castro is. I think he's a great guy to study, just because he's just an obvious actor. The whole revolution was completely theater. The key part of it was the Cuban Missile. That was really why they created him, why they got rid of Batista, because you couldn't. There is no way they could arrange some kind of Soviet connection with this character, so they had to pull someone in. He couldn't be a communist at the beginning because there would be no popular support. He seizes power. He kills everybody who is a real revolutionary. Now he's alone with what the Masons want, which is 100% political power, and now suddenly he's a Marxist. And then the next thing you know, you've got the Cuban Missile Crisis, and everybody's ducking and covering because of this war is about to break out. And we'd better have a huge military intelligence, don't we? We really need one of those in order to make sure that this never happens again. This, we came so close to nuclear war, but now don't worry, with an expanded CIA that's in every single country in the world, there's no chance this can happen again. We're going to be safe here in our little houses, being watched over by DARPA and, always sitting on our television sets watching the Kardashians.
Yes. Yeah. And it helped to have a boogeyman in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the Sandinistas. It helped there because, then you have this arena for drug dealing, arms shipping, arms dealing and getting the drugs into the country. A lot of money is being made. This money is then, a lot of the money, the drug funds that are raised in the States, capitalized some well-known corporations, from what I understand. I think there's a fried chicken franchise. There's a rather large department store chain or chain we all are aware of, and that are apparently was utilized to launder some of these funds and grew stupendously because of it. Silvano Gonzalez writes about Cuba. He says, "Changes in Cuba, don't hold your breath." This dates back to 2015. And he says, raises some worthwhile observations. I guess April 6th, 2015 issue of the CFO, he says, "Changes in Cuba, don't hold your breath." The April 6th, 2015 issue of the CFR's corporate member Time magazine showed a picture of a dilapidated house in Havana with the text, "Cuba will change when Americans arrive," imposed over the photo. Well, let me tell you what I think. Nothing will change in Cuba when the Americans arrive, because in most things, Castro's Cuba is a country more advanced than the U.S. Actually, Americans have much to learn from Castro's Cuba. No wonder a David Rockefeller and other CFR honchos are convinced that Castro's Cuba is a model to follow. So what can Americans learn from Castro's Cubans? Among other things, they can learn how to destroy the middle class. For more than a quarter of a century, the CFR conspirators have been working hard to destroy the American middle class. Well, Castro did in Cuba in just a few years. Before Castro took power in Cuba in 1959, with the help of the Rockefellers and their CFR agents in the U.S. government, Cuba was one of the countries in the world with the most expansive middle class. only second to the United States. Today, there are only two social classes in Cuba, the hyper-rich and a small group composed of Castro himself, his relatives and close associates, and the hyper-poor, consisting of 99% of the population, living in the most abject moral and material misery. Even more important, Castro did it without the help of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, a true accomplishment. Now, can Americans show the Castroist how to destroy an excellent medical care system while claiming that the calamitous new one is better? Can they destroy an excellent agricultural system that provided more than 90% of the needs of the population while gaining the admiration of Berkeley's progressive because allegedly the new system is ecologically sound? Can they show Cubans how to destroy an excellent system of public education by turning into a tool for ideological indoctrination? Can they turn a country where workers enjoyed one of the highest standards of living in Latin America into a nation of paupers? Note, the Castroists did it many years before the CFR conspirators did it in America. What else can Americans teach Castro? How to create a pervasive system of prisons and incarcerate a large percentage of the population? How to create re-education camps for dissidents? How to implement modern techniques for torture for political prisoners, including waterboarding? Don't make me laugh. Castro has been doing all this in Cuba for almost since he grabbed power in 1959. Another thing Americans can learn from Castro's Cuba is how to use the military to invade other countries to advance the interest of transnational corporations under the pretext of implementing democracy while passing as a hero of the progressive left. Nothing exemplifies this more than the case of the Cuban invasion of Angola in 1975. A few months after Castro took control of the country, Angola became one of the U.S. largest commercial partners in Africa. Chase Manhattan Bank, Bankers Trust, Citibank, and Morgan Guarantee gave large loans to Angola. The business of the General Motors, General Tire, Caterpillar, Boeing, IBM, NCR, Pfizer, Xerox, and other American corporations flourished in the country. 95% of Angolan oil was exported to Western countries. Castro's soldiers protected refineries in Cabinda from saboteurs, and Castro was paid in dollars for their services. Half of the production of Gulf oil in Angola ended up in U.S. refineries. The consortium of De Beers controlled diamond mines. So much for Castro's anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist policies. So I think it's a interesting take on the career and function of Fidel Castro.
And I think that the Cuban people are actually pretty solid, a lot more wholesome and healthy than the feedlot American people.
Well, it's like the point how they're too poor, so they don't have modern health care.
Yeah, they don't have modern health care.
So they're better off.
I'm sure about maybe vaccinations, but very few because they don't have any money. And also they eat better food. The food is horrible. It's not like, some kind of Spanish cuisine. It's just peasant fare. But I think they don't have a lot of chemicals, so it's more natural. So the people just look better. But, the thing that was most fascinating to me about Cuba, I was just astounded. I really wanted to. I actually had some people there that I was in touch with, and I've kind of lost track, and I'm hoping to reconnect that. But so the thing about Cuba that is the best is that they have good family structure. They really don't have that many out of wedlock births, and they're producing children. And you know what they don't have, Tim? They don't have pornography. They got zip pornography because, you see, they don't have the internet. I mean, if you want to use the internet in Havana, and I was there, I think it was like, 2012, I think maybe. Yeah. And I mean, you have to go to one of the tourist hotels and basically sign up, wait in line, and then you get something that is so slow, you might be able to get an email in like a half hour or something. It's just painful. So the people on the street back when I was there, there's just no pornography that's available. And so you don't have, and of course you don't have, perversions like weaponized feminism and even the weaponized integration. Cuba is like an integrated country, but you don't have to if you want to be for example, they actually have a more religious freedom there than you'd suspect. I mean, little Catholic enclaves can exist, because the government just doesn't have the money to stamp them out. When the Pope was there a few years ago, it was a huge event. The public really was happy to see the guy, and he was there with his Freemason symbols and whatnot. But anyway, so Cuba is a healthier society than the United States, because the weaponization of culture is less sophisticated.
Well, capitalism has proven to be a far more, I think, effective weapon in destroying traditional family, traditional cultural, morality than communism has. And we see that, I don't know if it was intended or not, but because they're denied some of the temptations or blandishments of, the capitalist West, consumer culture, sex, pornography, entertainment, these things. And we see the same effect like in Europe, where the countries that were behind the Iron Curtain tend to be ones that are most resistant and more traditional than the Western European countries. And so in a way, the consumerism of the West is far more effective in destroying family structure and morality, and has proven to be far more effective than communism.
Yeah, so that's really clear in Cuba.
I made the observation that the whole aesthetic of communism is concrete, barbed wire, barking dogs, not very appealing. In the West, you have consumerism. You have cheeseburgers, milkshakes, and women in bikinis. the point about the internet, you just don't have the opportunity. The temptations aren't there, and so traditional society, despite everything else, has able to maintain itself where it hasn't in the West.
The Cuban people are pretty beaten down and mind controlled. I mean, obviously they've been under a dictatorship for forever. I mean, remember, they were slaves for United Fruit before Castro came in, and then they had Marxism for up to the what was called the special period you mentioned. When Marxism left Cuba with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but so they've been basically beaten down, but. Because there wasn't the technologic slave state, with pornography, internet, and all the toxicities, and I think because they had like a more traditional Catholic family structure and culture, I think that even though Catholicism was, basically in some ways banned by Marxism, I think that its culture remained more or less intact. They didn't have the capacity, the government didn't have the capacity to really destroy it, so. You see people getting married, in churches, the whole family's there, it's like really kind of a things that you never see in the United States.
Is there feminism and gay rights yet in Cuba?
They,
I thought I read an article where one was.
They do have it, yeah, but it isn't, I mean, first of all, they have feminism in the sense that, I think about half the women doctors are women. Half of the doctors are women.
That was a trend you saw in a lot of communist countries. Yeah.
Yeah. So they did try to educate women and have a unitarian or kind of like a egalitarian roles for the sexes, but it hasn't really worked to the extent we went out night clubbing. God help it. You can imagine me like in my 60s in Cuba, but. I did it because, I was told by this guy that I was who I was into. He was a novelist that I had been communicating with before I got to Cuba, and he's kind of a well-known Cuban novelist. And so he says, "No, you got to see it." He says, and it was the dancing, was strictly heterosexual. There were no, I didn't see any. Kind of gay men anywhere in Havana. So the gay culture really wasn't played up at all. It wasn't like, New York City or Los Angeles, where it's such a promoted, aspect of culture. And there was romance. I mean, in other words, the dancing was very sensual and romantic. The couples would, they would dance the mamba.
Yeah.
And dances like that. And there was a kind of heterosexual energy that was just part of the world, but it was definitely heading toward families, because when you would go down the streets, it would be family structure. Mm-hmm. You go down like some of the streets in where I live. And I mean, the apartments, you don't see married people, I mean, just row after row of like single people living in apartments.
It's the whole condominium life was started in California, and that was there to promote sort of atomized single life in the 60s. Yeah.
So, but you don't see that. I didn't see that in Havana at all. I mean, what you see are families. I mean, they're absolutely dirt poor typically. But I wanted to give an example of, like, I was actually almost brained at this party by a American patriot zealot who asked me about Cuba, and I said, "Well, I think the quality of democracy is much higher there." I was just,
I know,
toying
yeah, I
with
know
him,
you.
but he just, I literally, he was just beet red. I thought he was going to slug me. And my point was is that, yeah, I mean, you have the Communist Party as a dictatorship, and that's kind of a pain in the ass, but they don't have a lot of money, or at least they don't present a lot of force on the street, so the people pretty much do what they want. And on the street, this is what they do. They have these little groups, I forget the name of it, but it's like a couple hundred people maybe. And this is a block. They all live in the same area, right? And so when they have little issues, they get together and vote. And they actually, this little group would elect one representative who then goes up and to another group. There's a name for this, I forgot. And then that group elects this Senate, right? And you end up with like 50 people who could then supposedly elect Raul, the next dictator once Raul dies. But the thing is, on the street for little local issues, everyone actually kind of knew what the issue was and had an opinion about it. And I'll just here was the big democratic crisis. There was a U.S. company that wanted to come in and put in like a store, right? Or I don't know if it was U.S., but it was like a clothing store, and they wanted to put one in on the block. And so the community got together and they took a vote and they decided against it. And you know why? Because these women who lived on the area and the block came up and said, "We make our living as seamstress, and we if you they come in, how are we going to make a living? We don't want to. We're good at this. You all wear our clothes, like." And so there was this big debate about it, and they actually turned the guy down. I was just astounded. I mean, you compare that to my democracy, Tim. I mean, if I tried to get a hold of Hannah Beth Jackson, or like, I mean, one of my elected representatives, I mean, I just they would call the NSA, if I so. There isn't any real democracy at all.
And
There's
also, it's
no.
out in the open where you have the Communist Party,
Yeah,
single
yeah. And so,
party, unitary state. Okay, at least it's out in the open. Where here in the States, we have this
And
facade of
we absolutely
democracy.
people talk. You get together. It's like E. Michael Jones talks about how you drive into your garage and you turn on the TV set, and then here you are in your little isolated world. You may or may not even have a wife, but you have the media, right? That's what you've got. This isn't happening in Cuba. There is no media. You drive home, and that's where the family and your extended community is, right there
Well,
in
God
the street.
forbid you talk to each other.
And believe me, Cubans talk. You know what was like the most amazing thing to me was the book fairs. And because remember, there's not much TV at this time. And so they read books. Like 98% of Cubans, something like that, are illiterate. Very high level literacy, too. It's like eighth grade or something. So they can actually read pretty well. And they have these book fairs where there's like thousands of books, most of them secondhand. And they're all for sale, but you can negotiate. And they've got every imaginable sort of, kind of well-known cultural icon writer. But they even have like economic stuff. They have anti-Marx books. They have all kinds of everything. They don't really care. There's no repression of what is available to read. But the fact is that people do read. They read books and then they talk to each other. They're actually sitting there. It's a real human sense of community. And I know, okay, I'm kind of glorifying it. I mean, you can take the other approach and talk about the dirty houses and like people hustling tourists, with kind of ugly proposition. There's a lot of stuff that is nasty, but I'm just saying that there's also kind of this core of what normal humans are like when you're not the victims of technological weaponized culture.
And it's not they have the presence of mind or consciousness to sort of reject globalism. Where you
Yeah.
want to maintain a local economy where all those resources and energy stayed local with those women running the seamstress, they're being seamstresses in those, and so they have these
Yeah.
little jobs are protected. It's interesting that E. Michael Jones has written about the effect of dumping surplus or cheap clothing on the in Africa, how that's prevented development there, because the there's no local one of the initial stages of economic development, you know, is textile, and this has prevented textiles from developing. What happens is, you know, you have people who buy up surplus cheap clothing around the world and dump it on the African economy. And the yeah. African states, I think this, his example is Tanzania. And same thing with, you know, with food, agriculture, and things like food aid, and things that destroys local agriculture. So it creates perpetual dependence. And doesn't allow for any economic development, any rudimentary.
Like IMF loans.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally, that's what that crap is. It's just, it's not in any way intended to help anybody. It's intended to create dependence, just like you say.
But yeah, that's one, you know, what's one of the effects of globalization is that, you know, the empire can exploit slave labor around the world to dump cheap products to prevent local economies from developing. And this is one how they manipulate, you know, the geography of production, as they say.
It's such a good point, Tim. And the fact is, the real latest victims of that rouge are the American people. We've got all this crap from China that they make in, you know, in China, and they sell at Costco. And we've lost our capacity inside, you know, to have these middle class, like, you know, small manufacturing businesses and stationery stores, things like this.
This creates local autonomy, by the way, local culture, and, you know.
Exactly. Oh no, a technical glitch.
I can hear you now.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. After the disaster of last show, I was afraid I dropped out again. You know, it's like, I don't trust Santa Barbara technology. We're kind of very primitive here. So, you know, Fidel is a fascinating character. I think people should, you know, spend more time, and we should try to actually expose him a little more clearly. I think he's a pretty obvious lifetime actor. You know, like someone like Hitler, who I think is a complete lifetime actor, I think it'd be hard because of just, you know, how powerful the iconic force, you know, in the mind is, you know, to really get into like where the Nazi Party comes from. That would be tough for, I think, a lot of people to walk down that path. But to expose Castro, I think that's actually something we could easily do. And then if we could do that, then people could use that as a template.
I mean, he is an icon of the Cold War, and the Cold War was sort of a managed dialectic, and so all the figures, you know, all these figures of the Cold War, at one level, I think to more of an extent, are, you know, were put in these positions to play certain roles, and some wittingly and some unwittingly, you know, that's how these things are managed.
Exactly. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, I think Guevara was legitimate. He was just a psychopath. And, you know, Castro got him for that very purpose. And then once he was no longer needed because he killed and intimidated everyone that Fidel maintaining his power, he got rid of him.
Yep. And of course, he was also competing in... Okay, Joe, you think we covered it?
He's a martyr. I think so, Tim.